Welcome. On behalf of the extraordinary host committee of SDC members that helped put this day together, and of course the Seattle Repertory Theater, thank you so much for having us here. I'm Laura Penn. I'm the executive director of the Stage Directors and Choreographers Society, and it's a privilege to be in this job. I want to thank everybody for coming this evening. I also want to just take a moment because there are a number of people who are just joining us now who have not been here for the entire day, as many of you have. And so I just want to give a little context for what we've been up to. We've been in discussion today with a group of, I think it's like over 60 directors and choreographers from Seattle, talking about process. Their work, their craft, sharing ideas and thoughts about things they do and things they may end up doing with the way the craft is changing. Directors and choreographers' lives can be a little isolating at times. They're often the only one in the room. You know, sometimes they have the privilege of working with a choreographer or a director, but mostly they're alone. And as a career progresses, there becomes fewer and fewer opportunities to spend time together. And there are very, very few career development opportunities for these artists, the way our culture is structured around their work. So we feel really grateful to be able to put something like this together and think about advancing the craft and the position of directors and choreographers in order to strengthen the support that exists for them, but actually to build and better the field. To make the industry as vibrant and significant as it can be, which builds and betters the world, we like to think. So hopefully you've had an opportunity to do some of that today. We're going to have a conversation here with Tony Taccone. It's worthy of hours of exploration. We're going to try to get as much as we can in the next 90 minutes. As you might expect, I've got some questions. We'll get some responses, and then we'll open it up for some questions.
Maybe.
You know, it was over 60 years ago today that community leaders and ambitious directors set about the founding of the regional theater movement. And today there is an ecosystem of literally thousands of theaters around the country. Whose relative strength and influence may differ from community to community, city to city, but what is true is that they are inextricably bound to the personality and the communities within which they rest. They help create the character of a region, and large and small, these theaters are economic drivers. They serve as anchors. And they contribute an enormous amount to creating an informed citizenry. We had to find a title for today's discussion, which can be a little reductive, but they always want a title. I mean, we're talking press releases, we're talking about the press release. It's a title. So the title, Making Theater Leading Communities. We want to explore how someone, in this case Tony Taccone, let's say, balances artistic organizational leadership with personal artistic ambitions, and how the synergy between those two things can lead to strong institutions and vibrant cultural communities. I'm not going to read Tony's bios. It's in your program. I do think it's worth repeating, however, that he has been referred to as the perfect artistic director.
My mother thinks I'm fantastic.
Yeah. And also the most prominent artistic director in the country.
Again, my mother.
Yes. Under Tony's leadership, Berklee Repertory Theater has become a force in the American theater, and he has weathered, you have weathered, many cycles through that theater, but always with a deep and abiding commitment to directing and producing important, impactful, complicated, beautiful work with your sight set on excellence. So, given our time, I'm going to skip over any more of your bio. I'm going to point you all to the SDC Foundation's podcast series. It's fantastic. Masters of the Stage. In the Masters of the Stage podcast series, you will find a number of conversations with Tony Taccone, which will reveal all of the biographical information. And it's pretty interesting. But let's begin. It is.
Whatever.
So I would like to start on this day of practicing artists with talking to you, Tony, about Tony the director. Something akin to kind of a lightning round, if you will, by understanding what drives you as a director. Starting with, what does a director do?
Imagines worlds. A director is somebody who has the capacity to reimagine the world. And every time you get on one of these rehearsal processes, it's the best thing. You get to live inside your imagination. You get to think about the world you want to reveal, how you're going to do it. And I mean, I think probably many of us feel the most excited when we're doing that. When you get in the hall and you got all these other things going on, it gets complicated. But when you're in that room, it's going, oh my God. And that's also learning. My father he was an artist, and so was my grandfather. And my father used to say that the secret to life is curiosity. And I believe it. I believe it. And I feel like that's the gift of being a director. You get to learn every single time out. And there's nothing that makes time fly or make you feel me happier. They're learning. So that's what a director does.
Fantastic.
Ha! Boom!
There you go.
Boom!
I landed it.
Booyah!
When did you know you were a director?
I was in a repertory company in Colorado in grad school, post-grad school. I was an actor, really bad actor, but I was good at comedies. Mm-hmm. Put me in a pair of tights, instant laugh. So that was, and then we were acting, and we were rehearsing four plays, and we had rehearsed three of them, and we were about to go into rehearsal for the fourth play, and I got a knock on the door the night before rehearsal starts, and the producer comes and says, the director bailed. Do you want to direct this thing? I was like, okay. So sure. So I tried, and honestly, it's the closest thing I've ever had to like an epiphany. Within an hour of doing it, I could feel like parts of myself that were formerly either not being asked to engage or were dormant or whatever, I could just feel like, one, I'm gonna be better at this than acting. So that was a bottom line thing, but I could just feel parts of myself becoming alive. And I just feel like this is worthy of my focus and my time. So then I got serious about it. I went to grad school, yeah. Did all that thing.
So, who are some directors that you...
Went to grad school with Richard White, by the way. Yay.
And neither of us got a PhD.
Exactly. We're in the program. I went farther than you, Doug. This dude, legendarily, shows up at the exams. Legendary, shows up at the exams, is in there for 20 minutes, goes, tears up the paper, and goes, I'm out. I mean... That is cojones on display.
Oh my God. Who are some directors that you admire and what draws you to
Richard
their
White.
Work?
There's many, many people I admire and for different reasons. I mean, there's obviously the auteurs, you know, people whose particular style dominates the entire aesthetic strategy of their work, people who, you know, work in a particular signature. Right, and Ivo van Hove, obviously, is a guy like that. You go to see Ivo van Hove, and then on the fourth one, you're like, oh, okay. you know, so, I mean, he's a brilliant guy, but that is, his style is the dominating language that's interfacing with the text. And then there's, you know, the Alan Fletcher's, you know, there's the ensemble person, somebody who's trying to realize what that particular world is, and become almost invisible inside of it. So there's a huge spectrum of people whose work I admire. So rather than singling anybody out, I'll just say those I appreciate excellence, obviously, and I think actually one of the gifts I had from my parents actually is that I really do appreciate excellence. Like, I'm not threatened by it. Mm-hmm. So that's allowed me to be generous with other people, and I think that's been important when you're running a theater, is to really be a fan of every artist who walks in the building. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to do that. Because I've seen cases where that isn't the case, where, you know, I've been to theaters where I felt like people, you know, were kind of rooting sort of, you know, almost against me. As if I'm like, wow, how did that happen? You know, I'm at your theater, dude. But I don't feel that way. I feel like there's a lot of great arts out there, and what a great gift running a theater where we get to invite people of enormous talent skill to come and share their work with us. I've had it lucky, man. I mean, I've you know, Berkeley Rep, it's very rare when an individual's ambition is matched by an institutional ambition. It's very, very rare. Usually, you know, you hit a ceiling, you're like, okay, I'm out. Mm-hmm. But with my particular situation, it's not just that I'm a very slow person, it's also this confluence of the fact that Berkeley Rep's ambition to grow in a dramatic way matched where I was at. So I've been there for 33 years now, so nobody can say I didn't try.
Yeah. I imagine that you have a great deal of affection for many, if not all, the projects you've worked on. Maybe not all, but
even some of the hardest, even some of the most difficult ones. You know, there's obviously that we all understand what it means to overcome obstacles or to grapple with really hard questions. And you know, none of us are foolish enough to think we solved things. I mean, you just engage to the best of your ability, with every molecule you have available to you, with what the myriad of challenges are. And, but I mean, there are obviously for each of us, there's some place that you personally feel were more important to you in terms of what challenges you were able to embrace. I did productions at the Eureka that I feel, you know, when I did Fen, for example, there was a production of Fen where the staging challenges were such that, you know, how we solved those challenges were really exciting. And I did Pickle Road there, which is an immersive play, which is, you know, the audience was in that. So you're dealing with, you know, environmental theater. Well, we used to call environmental theater, now called immersive theater.
Right.
So it's just, it's a, you know, everyone says, it's immersive! It's just another name for the same thing. So, there are certain plays that, and when I did Coriolanus, is the first Shakespeare play I did at Ashland. That was a big one for because you're grappling with like this incredible mind. You know, when you're dealing with this material, we all have had experiences, right, where the material's like blowing your mind. Well, like I remember doing Beckett and just sitting there going, I cannot believe wrote that line. I just cannot believe his imaginative framework was such that he'd reveal that to him that moment. So, you know, you encounter other artists. I mean, some of the best relationships I've had were people who are dead, you know, because they don't talk back. It's fantastic. We all have had this experience where there's a level of execution, perfection, whatever you want to say, there's a level of brilliance, of grace, of revelation that you're in the presence of, that you're just trying to match it. You're trying to, you know, marry what you've got to what that universe is asking of you. And it's just, that's why we do this shit, man. It's like, it's a thrill. It's just thrilling. So, it's how we get high. So,
right.
It's cheaper than
sometimes.
Sometimes. Well, with the price of meds these days, you know.
Yeah. So we are in, I don't think it's an understatement to say we're really in a time of transformation, culturally.
Transformation,
Yeah, recalibration. Uh-huh. You know, there's a lot of new learnings, specifically, and we spent some time, folks did today, talking about some of this relative to their craft. I want to talk with you just a little bit about the center of your work. And you've directed many difficult, complicated productions. And I found a couple of quotes I just want to share. So excuse me while I actually read here. One is in reference to Niels Anderson that you studied with in Colorado. You referred to working with him as a kind of an outward bound class. But I quote, it was like pushing you past your physical limitations, a kind of forcing you to do things you never could conceive of doing. Just that alone was a sort of seminal experience in terms of seeing, oh, the mind has its own construct and the body has its own will. And if you can push past that, this has become my tenet with actors. You can do that. You don't think you can, but you can do that. The second quote is, to really change, I think you either have to be forced to in a traumatic sense or be invited to and feel safe enough to be able to actually go to a place you never thought you could go. So as a director, how do you push artists you are working with and create a safe space, brave spaces that are sometimes referred to today, in this moment in particular?
Well, obviously this moment is unlike any other moment, you know, we've ever experienced, not only just personally, but in our terms of our national history. So obviously we're all dealing with, I mean, the intimacy conflict you just had is a reflection of that. I mean, how can we construct a safe environment in the rehearsal hall, given the amount of issues that have been dormant that are now on the surface and the kind of confusion that has unleashed, and how does, as people who are responsible for clarity, how do you sort of give space to the confusion and yet bring clarity? So that's a challenge everyone has to face. And so I don't think there's a one answer to this, because I mean, I have a particular style, you've got a particular style, you've got a particular style, you've got, everyone's gonna bring their own particular, personality traits and thoughts and ideas, you know, to the rehearsal hall. I really like to laugh. I really like to get everybody both laughing at ourselves and laughing at what we're doing. I like to, I've never been accused of not being blunt enough. Sometimes, and I've had to, you know, I've obviously, but also you guys know, if you take any four people in a room, not everybody needs the exact same thing. So the job is to be sensitive enough to individual needs, but to have a kind of unity of language that feels like we are together doing something. I'm not gonna privatize the rehearsal process so that I'm speaking a very different language to you, because that's like, well, what is he saying to her versus him? You know, so it's like, we all have different ways of leading, we all have different ways, so I think the goal is to find your own mojo. I mean, I like to study coaches, for example, because there's a lot of different ways to coach. There's the players coaches, and then there's the authoritarians, and then there's a lot of different ways to win. So it's about motivating people. It's about getting people to move together towards, you know, one goal, and then everyone has a different comfort zones with, like, you know, managing the process. We're also talking about now a particular kind of process. So in my theater, we've struggled because we have a typical rehearsal process. 4 weeks until tech, a week of the previews, and then we open. Usually, one of the biggest challenges of regional theater has been including artists who make work in a different way. How do you accommodate different processes for making work, right? So how can we work with the hypocrites, and how can we work with companies that come in, or how can we, you know, when we want to do a play that won't bear the limitations of a four. So what you've had now is with this newer interest in new work is that the workshop has become the way to digest material over time, right? So now, honestly, I'm doing like musicals now, of all things. Go figure. I mean, I'm suddenly a Mr. Musical. But, you know, there's usually three workshops before the show. You know, there's the workshop to just work on the text in a small way with the artist. There's with the creative team. Then there's a workshop to get a stage reading going with maybe some of the people you want to use. and to bring, to start to introduce different vocabularies, like if we're gonna do a dance, what is the, where's the vocabulary of that? And the last one is like, put the thing up and see what you got before you went to rehearsal. So, and there are economic implications to that. But the American Theater has tried to find these other tools, you know, to develop work in a more sophisticated way. And you know, you learn the hard way. I mean, I did a season, you know, when the title of a play becomes a verb on your staff, it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. As in, I've been blanked by that show. You know? So I started doing new, I came out of the gate and about 2000, I made a decision that I thought that we were positioned in a unique way in the American theater because I feel like we're in the Bay Area. Bay Area, when you think about the Bay Area, what do you think about? You actually think about people, it's actually known for the alternative to conventional thought. There's a lot of people in that town who are there to actually explore different ways of inventing new stuff, whether it's psychotherapy or a new app or a new bit. So I thought, well, we have an opportunity. I made a decision to kind of move into bringing new work more towards the center of what we do as opposed to the outside. And so, but I just started doing it and it wasn't ready to go up. I mean, the plays were not ready. And here's an example of something that I felt was I took responsibility. A director came to me who I love. This guy's really, really talented, a very, very unique guy. And he said, I have an idea for the show. And I said, what is it? He said, I'm going to put 100 people, we're going to come in into the loading dock, I'm going to make them all part of the force. And Teresa said, that is a fantastic idea. No, they can't afford that. And I said, okay. So every week he'd come back to me, and the number kept getting smaller, smaller, smaller. Until finally I said, yes. He got down to 11 people or something. And he agreed. He agreed. Great, you're gonna do this, it'd be great. The show didn't work. And it was my fault. That guy's a freelance artist. That guy wants that job. He's gonna be predisposition to agree, you know, at his own peril. And when that show failed, I was like, I cut the guts out of that show. That guy had a brilliant idea. Rather than make perhaps the more difficult choice early on, so I'm saying this is not a show that I even know how to do well. What we should have done is gone to a workshop with that show for like 2 years and figure out how to do it. We didn't have that mechanism at that time. So these mechanisms were born out of failures. How can we incubate this work? How can we protect every single show you do? You have to put in a position to succeed, a position. When Braden is scheduling this house versus the other one, he's thinking, what's the best chance this show has to succeed? If 80 people in this house is a smash hit, 80 people in the other one, not so much. But the feeling, the energy, the adrenaline, the sense of the show, it's important that you come out of the gate feeling like, you know, you got the green light. Any new show, all you want is one thing. The collective sense that you have a second chance. That's the only thing I go for with a new show. Mm-hmm. So these things, you know, like I said, they were hit and miss, and then finally, I know you wanted to get to this, yeah. But finally, I was getting really tired. We were getting really tired of the artistic staff. I was tired of just trying to farm out our development work every single place we could. Like, can we go to the Playwright Center? Can we go to the Sundance? Can we go here? Can we get other people to pay for our development work? And I was like, and we were just flying all over the country, over the world, to go to our own development processes, and it felt stupid. It felt like, you know, and obviously you get how can we get somebody else to pay for this stuff, right? It just didn't feel right. And I also felt at that time that Berkeley Rap as a regional theater was getting too far away from what it was put on the earth to do, which is essentially one thing: create a safe home for artists. a safe place where people can create. That's what this whole thing was born on. The whole thing was born on trying to get out of the rigors of New York and the commercial world. Hence, we're doing all this commercial shows right now. But how to get away from the rigid strictures of that and create intelligent, sophisticated, relatively large-scale work for a sophisticated audience that would appreciate the work for what it was. And so, out of this, when we started to do new work more voluminously, we just said, we need to create an internal structure inside this building that is there to develop, to consistently create new work. Because I learned really the hard way, if something's not a line item in the budget, it is not gonna last. You know, when you first start out, you go like, I have a great idea. If ideas are just a function of your energy, your excitement, that's gonna go. That shit's gonna go. Because your excitement's gonna go up and down like this. But if it's a consistent programmatic, you know, function of the institution, then you have a chance of getting past the cycles of passion that we have or don't have. So we came up with this idea of forming a significant arm of our organization, which now is called the Ground Floor, where we take applications from all over the United States. This year, 600 people applied. So there is a need out there. We modeled some of it on Sundance, which a number of us had been totally liked, around the idea, simply about the idea that it felt really good to eat together. Mm-hmm. And it felt really good to break bread with each other and bring together artists who weren't working on the same idea into a relaxed atmosphere. There is no pressure to show anything at the Ground Floor. You don't have to show anything to anybody, ever. So that's another thing that because usually the theater wants to know, what's the payoff, what's the metrics, the metrics, the metrics, the metrics. I'm like, the metrics are people. The metrics are like, we've always had to do that, and I did have to, you know, wrangle a couple of projects out of the Ground Floor and go, I'm gonna do these things, so they need to show what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And there has been, I think, some pressure on the Ground Floor to take projects that are at a little bit more of an advanced stage of their evolution, because we take a lot of immersion work, a lot of just, I just have an idea, fine, come. So we pick about 20 projects a year and there's a residency in June, so people come for either a week or 3 weeks, and we supply you know, with whatever you need. I mean, some people come wanting a whole cast of people, some people just want to be in a room by themselves, some people. But it's how Fairview was born. Jackie came, and we just liked her. She's one smart-ass woman, and she's amazing. So like, I stopped picking plays about 10 years ago. I started just pick artists. Really, I just stopped. You know, you got at that stage. You're like, you know, you're in trouble when you're like looking through your bookcase. Picking a season, you're like, okay, the Duchess of Malfi, I'd love to do that. But it's like, I just started feeling like that exercise was draining me. I was just not getting the right energy. And then fortunately, we started to attract a bunch of artists who I thought were just, and then it becomes a kind of, when you have the ground, it was really helpful. The Ground Floor has been extremely helpful. Because once you say, okay, these two plays are coming out of the Ground Floor and going to be in the season, it makes the season planning just easier.
But there's a couple of threads I want to come back to the Ground Floor in just a minute. But you said something, directors. So, and the director who, the freelance director who just wants to say yes because they want the next job, they want the. I've seen my own experience in the regional theater, and I was at Arena Stage with Zelda and Tom, and Garland Wright was the associate artistic director, and I mean, it's like, man, right? Direct. I mean, I was I've been super blessed to be around or inside some of the most remarkable moments in the theater. It feels to me like, and I've talked with other folks about the fact that the freelance director today needs to come in and go out, do a good production, you know, be nice to the staff, and, you know, stay on budget, and then we'll take you to the airport. The idea that, I mean, I don't know what theater in the country would hire Garland Wright today to do a production, right? Some of these, like, directors with this kind of expansive vision. And so for the freelance director, and it's part of why what we did today and this idea of some kind of professional development, renewal, inspiration, for the freelance director who's trying to find their voice in this system we have in the regional theater is feels hard to me right now. Do you know what I'm talking about? Uh-huh. Do you?
Well, I mean, I think it's always been hard, number one. I think being a freelancer is always hard. I think it's hard emotionally, because I think you're more alone. I mean, both my sons are artists and freelance artists, and watching them, and then we were talking earlier, a few of us in Braden's office, and a number of really wonderful folks are on the faculty of universities, and talking about just, you know, empowering students to be their own business, essentially. They are their own brand. You have to now have agency over your own life, your social media accounts, your audience. You are a brand. And I think while that's really necessary and smart and feels like the only way to interact in a hyper-capitalist economy, which is what we're in now, I also think it's dangerous. I think it's, how do you get a feeling of community? I mean, I'm not in community like, Jen, you know, I mean, talking about who are your people? Who are your people that you go to? They're like, go, did that suck? They go, yeah. That suck, man. You gotta go back and redo that. You know, I mean, and you do that in a good way. I mean, it's like, Richard and I grew up, you know, and many of you did too, but we came out of the Eureka Theater, which was a company-based situation, right? And for all the fraughtness of it, and it was fantastically fraught, I mean, spectacularly fraught. There was a sense of just moving through it together. And so now there's a particularly, in this highly traumatic moment that we're all experiencing with the political administration, the advantage of it is it's bonding people together. If people are like, yeah, we get the army and let's go after the, you know, let's go after this. And so I think the some of the students, the guys were sharing with me their experience of like feeling like this newest generation of students is more politically aware. They're more attuned to the actual contradictions of the moment. So they want to engage in those contradictions. That's messy, but it's also real, and we like real. I mean, that's one of the big things. I think we do real well. So I think trying to find, as a freelancer, you know, where your strength is among your peers, among your colleagues, among your friends. I think, you know, I'm agreeing with what you're saying, because I do think that the regional theater, I mean, our situation is a little different too, because now, I chose to do something which is somewhat controversial in the sense that we did Angels in America last year, and that was just us, and we did that, and the production cost about $1.5 million to do, and that's a lot of money. But, you know, we also have done commercial shows where we are asking for producers to give anywhere between $1.5 and $3 million. For show, you know, when somebody is bringing that kind of money to the table, they have the right to say, I have an opinion here, you have to listen to me. So that's complicated. My friend Oscar Eustace, who runs the public, you know, he's really involved with this. They move a ton of shows. And he said the biggest drag of his job right now is he just spends so much time with commercial people. And it's just, but it's the deal. It's the deal you make, right? So, everyone's got the money issue. Nonprofit theaters. Oh my God, we're always like, we don't have enough money and all this stuff. And how do you grow? You have a fixed number of seats. right? And the income stream, you know, you can only raise the price so much. You know, we have about 14,000 subscribers, which is a pretty healthy amount, but, you know, the prices, inflation just goes up. Same amount of seats, inflation goes up. So how are you going to deal with rising costs? So we have chosen to do some shows that, you know, were ticketed to a commercial life. And we've had some success with that. I mean, Ancient Proud is going to run for a long time in New York. And I think it will kick off an income stream for the theater. Yeah. It will definitely kick off an income stream as an American Idiot. And you're not going to make a ton of money, but if you hit the lottery with that, like Hamilton or something, you know, Hamilton will make $2.5 billion by the time it's done. That's a lot of money, but that's a once in a lifetime experience. But I'm sure Brady's dealing with this. You know, how can we keep going with the economic resources that we need within a limited, you know, income stream?
So let's talk about. Let's talk, go back to the ground floor then, because what's interesting to me, so you've been in, I know this from, you guys have gone through cycles. You know how to spell cash flow. You know, these are things that are not foreign to you.
Right.
And yet, you know, Berkeley Rep is in a pretty strong, influential position at this point.
Mm-hmm.
If I think about it, the ground floor was announced in the fall of 2011.
Right.
For that kind of initiative to be announced publicly, there you had to have been thinking about it, I don't know.
It's 10 years before.
Okay.
But really
starting to think about it, I don't know, about the time the world came apart in 2008, 2009, and we're in the midst of the biggest financial crisis that we've seen since the Great Depression.
Right.
And you're saying, here's what I want to do.
Right.
I want to create this place where we can just have people come and think.
Right. Well,
how did you do that?
Well, we a couple things. One, we were relentless about it, and we spent a lot of time with the board explaining things. We had the advantage, and I think Seattle, it strikes me externally, and I don't mean to be, you know, arrogant about this, but one thing is that there's some serious venture capitalists on our board who understand risk. Those people invest in 10 businesses and one works. They get that model easily. They have no problem with that. So I actually started going after those people. Mm-hmm. And we have one particular guy on our board who took the lead in that. Mm-hmm. And he started to make a place for those kinds of people with me and Susie. And so that became a kind of, okay, we have a conversation with these people. Not all of them, because they don't believe in philanthropy. They believe in their app. Their app is philanthropy. So we had to, but we came up with a business model that they like, oh yeah, that makes sense. So there's that. And then we were, I made sure that every board meeting for 20 years, we talked about art. We talked about art. We talked about the intention of art, the ambition of art, the function of art, the unknowingness of art, the difference of art, the landscape of the imagination. You know, we talked about that, and we talked about the ground floor as being a conduit to that. Now, how they interpreted that was like R&D. The ground floor of them is just R&D. Every healthy business in the world has an R&D department. If you're going to be innovative, you can't do it without R&D. You can't do it. So it made some sense to those people. So you find the language that people understand. I once watched Michael Tilson Thomas, who's the famous head of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, talk to his audience once before a concert. And I think on the bill he had Beethoven's Ninth and some other very, very weird, challenging sonata. And he turned to this audience and he said, we're going to do Beethoven's Ninth. I know that's why you're here. But we're going to do this other thing. And I'll tell you a little bit about the man who wrote this and what he was doing. And in 15 minutes, he taught them an art appreciation class. And he then had the orchestra play three short passages from what they were about to hear. That audience when those passengers came around, they were rooting for them. He was like, I got it. So I've always felt that we are conducting a lifelong class in art appreciation, all of us. You have to take it on that way. It's the only way to understand what you're doing and make some sense and get energy from it. You can't be saying, oh, no, they're fucking done, or I gotta talk. It's not about that. You know, it's not about that. It's about teaching people and teaching yourself about art. And if you get off on that, then you won't have any problem with that. So it's getting people excited about something they don't think they know about. It's getting people to understand it and understand the complexity of it and understand and getting comfortable with and excited about the unknown. Like, excited about that. Something that the vast majority of human beings commit their entire life to ignoring or rejecting or putting aside. It's scary. And we traffic in it. Everybody in this room traffics in the unknown. Why does stuff come up in rehearsal? Because you're trafficking in your unconscious. Right? Your stuff's coming up. You know, and there's this, obviously we're using the vocabulary now of triggering all the stuff, but when you make a piece of art, you are in a direct dialectical relationship between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind. And you're actually trying to release what's in your unconscious and make some sense out of it in your conscious mind. So I talk about that to the board a lot.
Before or after the finance report. Yeah, that's the. Speaking of the board, speaking of change, there's a lot happening right now. We're now a generation or two removed from the founders of our regional theaters. Mm-hmm. There's a sea change of artistic leadership.
John Dill sitting over there, this is like one of the granddaddies of the whole thing, man.
You know, we're in the folks are either in the midst of searching for new leadership or welcoming new leadership. In many cases, new leadership that looks quite different than the leadership. Yeah. I won't say often yet, but certainly we are beginning to see some shifts. And it's no longer a nascent experiment. These are big mm-hmm. companies. A lot of them are. And they have to be fed, and they have to be clothed, mm-hmm. and they have to be taken care of in a different way. And yet they were founded with a singular artist, who was the manifestation of the mission, the vision, through which it sort of communicated. What is the significance of a practicing artist in the center of these organizations, or what does that mean, or what's...
Well, I mean... Michael Wilson used to say, like an artistic director was an animating artist at a theater. I think it's somewhat complicated. I mean, everyone has different styles of leadership, and you know the paradigm that we inherited certainly was a very much of a patriarchy. You know, either a benevolent monarchy or a kind of autocratic, visionary, and that definitely produced a generation of in some instances, extraordinarily gifted. Garland Wright was part of that generation, right? John Jory and the guy, the people who founded those theaters. Zelda, in many ways, was part of that. She was very hierarchical. So then this next generation that came out of the 60s came in, and we were like, yeah, free love. What is this thing? Oh, hierarchy. Ooh, okay. But you sort of learn that you have to make decisions and you have to manage people, that management isn't a bad thing. It's just the style of management can be more inclusive and can be more robust and more, so now we have this other moment happening right now, just where people are challenging that paradigm and going, like, what if we undid the whole thing? Or what if we had people of a different color and gender and all those roles? And so I think that's going to change. And I just think that for all of it, though, for me, the only thing that has made sense in any relationship in my life is respect. Because if there's a mutual sense of respect, we can kind of go to a very deep place. right? So if there's not that, though, then I think all the Pandora's box is wide open, and all kinds of stuff gets released, and we're just in a very, all the cards are suddenly rigged. It feels very, very scary and kind of stressful. Obviously, I do believe that, you know, the best way to change is when you're feeling safe. You know, when you feel like you are being invited to look at yourself in a different way. And in a way, but if there is a respect coming from the person who's criticizing you or challenging you, you will listen. I mean, the question is, when do you stop listening? You know, obviously it's very hard to listen to the president right now because there's just this sense of abuse and, you know, violation happening in every word that comes, you know, out of his mouth. So it's very hard to respect the office of the presidency right now for me. I was like, oh yeah, I can respect the office of the president, I just don't like the president. So without, but if you have respect, you can make a lot of those different systems work. But when you don't have that, then I think, like I said, all bets are off. I think that, you know, moments of change are always hard. I mean, and no one knows what's gonna happen. I don't know if this paradigm shift is gonna stick or yield better results. I mean, I think it is. I once had a literary manager who came over to us from the National Theatre in England, and we were in the process of building our second theatre, which is a much bigger theatre. And, you know, we were having these meetings, and she turned to me at one point, she said, "Tony, you don't understand. The bigger the organization, the smaller the number of people at the meetings." And I was like, huh. And it stayed with me, because when you get an organization where there's 160 employees, you know, I don't really try to remember your name unless you've been there for a year. It's just too many people coming in and out. I mean, I say hi, hey, great, but I it's just too many people. So how do you get a sense of institutional respect? There's more pressure than on the middle managers, the layers, everyone's got to feel like they're in a participatory environment, everyone's got to feel. But you know, honestly, it's about creating a culture. Mm-hmm. If the culture is healthy, it can absorb more fracture. The less healthy it is, the less fracture it can absorb. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I'm going to open it up.
You weren't ready for that.
That was a surprise. Surprise is the DNA of theater. Yes.
You said this is a moment of recalibration. You talked about respecting in this moment of change. As one of the experts on making new theater, when and why and how do you actually step back and give your megaphone to somebody else who's not yet an expert in making new theater, but is an expert in something that you are not an expert in?
So give me an example.
People have been excluded from the hierarchy of power in theater because of their race, because of their gender, because of their religion. And so we have, in some sense, had a somewhat homogenous view from the top. So how do you step back and elevate somebody else who has not been part of this power structure?
Well, those are individual choices, obviously. You have to make, the question is, who has the power to make the choice? If I'm still having the power to make the choice, I have to make an assessment. If I want to feel like I'm putting this person in a position to succeed, then I would want to feel like they are capable of moving up to that level of responsibility. We actually, like Berkeley Rep, so for example, we actually hire a lot internally. We actually promote a lot of people internally. Like the number of fellows that are now on staff is really high. So many come through. We like to give people the opportunity to sort of grow at the theater. And obviously we're cognizant of background. We started to recruit at different places a lot. So, you know, we go to black colleges a lot to actually talk about, we're up to get our interns so they can get them in the field. We look for middle managers, you know, all this stuff's happening right now. So we have, in terms of just staff stuff, we've changed how we meet, how we talk about things. We changed the time structures of meetings just to allow just different kinds of ways that people can talk to each other. With certain issues, we definitely lean very strongly towards people talking to each other as opposed to using the middle person to talk through somebody. We very much encourage people if you have a problem with somebody, that you try to talk to them first, as opposed to, I mean, obviously if there's a loaded situation, people come to us and say, I'm having a light situation. But I mean, again, if the culture is right, the predilection for people talking to each other increases. Does that make sense? So,
do you think, Tony, you said earlier that your season planning, if I can just maybe build off this question, your season planning approach has shifted in that, you know, it's not the bookshelf looking at the plays, mm-hmm. but it's sort of finding the artist that excites you or you feel something for. Given the changing nature of the artist pool, and we are beginning to see more voices, do you feel like that feels like that might be driving a change?
Well, honestly, that's why the ground floor was born. The ground floor was born because literally we weren't having access, direct relationships with people. I mean, the ground floor is like, I mean, it's like, it's fantastic that way. I mean, we've identified so many really different
people. Fairview.
Yeah, Fairview. There's all kinds of workbook that's come out of that, and stuff that we haven't done, but we happily encourage and send on. I mean, you know, it's very diverse. It's extremely diverse, and the combustibility and the excitement of those kinds of artists coming together, and then us having an investment in them. It's really a way for us to keep track of a much, much wider pool of people, give them opportunities that we feel we can see how they work, you know, in an environment that feels safe for us, as opposed to going down a list of people I don't know, but I'm like, sure, let's bring them out. I don't, you know, it's very hard to get a sense of how people work until you see their work like three times, mm-hmm. you know, to know if you can actually vibe with them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got also the criteria is not, we've produced work that I didn't love personally, but I thought was really worthy. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important thing to do, is to challenge yourself. I mean, when Sunday Go Fairview was just not really written. Mm-hmm. It was just like, okay. I mean, but my conversations with Jackie, with Sarah, who's, you know, the director, just gave me great faith in these guys. I mean, that's just one successful example. There are other examples of where like it didn't quite work, but I never regretted investing in the relationship. I never regretted not supporting an artist mm-hmm. who's talented. I mean, and measuring success is tricky, you know?
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, you talk about the unknown. You talk about the long gestation of an idea, like the ground floor.
Right.
Do you have a hunch about the thing that is coming up next for the American theater?
I think someone's going to have to change the paradigm at the big. I mean, there's a number of things. So externally, I think we're going to have to remarket ourselves entirely. I think that the death of newspapers has happened. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's happened. We need to, as a field, recognize that and figure out what we're going to do to get our audiences energized, reach our audience. I mean, social media, obviously, like that, but there's other things going on there. But I think there's a bigger, you know, wheel to be turned about that. I think with development, there's going to be a whole new set of people we have to go after. People we haven't even included before, but are like, yeah, this is possible. To talk to these people, because somebody said, I think it was Valerie. Yeah, Valerie said in the conversation we were having earlier, Oh, you're right there. Valerie said that we need to get the word out that these stories, the multiplicity and spectacular eclecticism of these stories need to be heard. And you know what? People love stories. Netflix is a perfect example of this. What is Netflix doing? Netflix is telling a billion stories. They're just you got a good story to tell? Fine. You'll find this audience that. Now, obviously, they're a machine, and they figured out a way to, you know, showcase that material and access the material in a way that feels like a lot of people can kind of pick and choose. But I think the same thing. These stories are interesting, and that people don't give a shit about. I don't honestly think a big change in my thinking came. Because we had this meeting, we were doing the whole five classics and a play from New York, you know? And, you know, it worked for a long time. It was a revolutionary idea when it first appeared, and then it became not revolutionary. And then I was like, okay, what do people think of as a classic? So I had this board meeting where I said, okay, what's a classic? Oh, they dug themselves into such a hole. It was so fun. It was so much fun. It's when the guy's dead. It's when stood the test of time. I love that one. Stood the test of time. It's got universal, you know, people could not agree on anything. And I started to feel like they just felt safe. They just felt, oh, I'm seeing great theater. Because it's been accepted that this is great theater. So I started figuring out that people only want one thing, quality. That's the only thing they want. And you have to deliver that and overcome some of their hesitations about about the kind of material they think will give them a quality experience. Mm-hmm. So that's when we went after a whole new criteria. And I wasn't, you know, was entirely, you know, laissez-faire about it. I thought, and if I'm going to do this, I've got to introduce it with some really established writers. So I was doing Kushner, you know, and David Edgar, and Carol Churchill, along with, you know, Ian Mar Moses, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, nobody had heard of. So... But breaking down that paradigm about what people think they know versus what they don't. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing when people get upset. You know, like when people come to a theater, right? They have this unspoken contract. You know, I come to Berkeley Rep because it gives me this kind of experience, right? And they don't really think about it until that contract gets broken. I didn't sign up for this. Yet in all the years I've been coming, let us always say that. My husband and I have been coming since the dawn of man. And now this. Right? So outrageous. So you have to keep, you know, introducing people to material that they don't think they're going to like, but they walk out going, that was pretty amazing. You have to blow their minds at some point. You have to, like, we did a premiere of Laramie Project. And, you know, advertising, a show about the murder of Matthew Shepard. It's going to be great. You know, and it was an elegiac, brilliant production. So people come in thinking, oh my God, what is Tacomi going to subject me to now? They come out going, that was amazing. So but you have to do it consistently. You can't do it once a year. You have to keep doing it. That's my experience. You have to keep doing it so that becomes then the theater. They come with that. Right now, if I were to do two classically focused up program, I would get hate mail, which is awesome. That's awesome.
In the spirit of thinking about sort of new and what's next, one of the things we spend a lot of time on at the union is this the electronic capture and exploitation of stage work, and the fact that technology has advanced to such a point that you actually can kind of dynamically capture the theatrical experience. I know you were involved somewhat with Passing Strange.
We did the premiere.
Yeah, and the capture, you know, Spike Lee captured that, which was sort of different. But there's a lot of these things starting to happen, and some question about whether there could be a catalog that would be deep enough that you could build a subscription model in the Amazon Prime or network, you know, Netflix kind of way, Broadway HD. What do you think?
Well, the only theater that's really done that, internationally, is the National.
Yeah, National's been
extremely
successful.
Which is, you know, all of you have probably seen, you know, in every city, usually one art house that is presenting Helen Mirren, you know, in Medea or something.
And
it's amazing. I mean, you can watch, you know, very, very extraordinary and famous actors on the screen for like $10 in a play that you like. We've talked to the National a lot about their apartment. It's very expensive. They break even really, but they do it for their brand. They're known globally now, and so you get a different kind of payback for that. But the challenge of that, of course, is that the technology. I mean, you really need to spend a lot of money to invest in that. You know, and then I only think that works on honestly with a 3 or 4 camera shoot. I think that you're never going to get that with a single camera.
No, and
you have to have a crew that knows how to shoot.
I just wonder where that's going. I mean, you streamed Ain't Too Proud. Like a park.
Well, we wanted to wait because Ain't Too Proud was such a gigantic hit, and people were not being able to get in. So what we did was there's a film institute right in the corner there, and they have a huge outdoor screen. So we got into a agreement with them where like we could just an audience could come for free on the closing weekend and just watch the show. On the green, and you know, it was just great because I mean, people were lined up in the morning. It was like doing a show in the park in Central Park, which is one of the great theater institutions in the United States. I mean, free theater in the park. I mean, yeah, that sounds good. But I do think there's some hooks in that. One is, you know, famous people tend to drive it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're watching stars of some kind. And the camera shooting is of such a quality that you can do it. I mean, so I do think that there, you know, the Taper for a while had a film wing. Spielberg gave them some money. He had a first look deal with them where any play that he saw that he thought, you know, would be realizable, he would put some money into, and then they would do a film thing up for it. Didn't really last. I think something's going to stick like that. Something is going to change because, you know, obviously people in Turlock are never coming to Berkeley Rec. How can we give people in Turlock an experience other than touring, which is very, you know, it's just very challenging now because, you know, hiring the bus to get the eight actors. Now, having said that, the public is doing a national touring project. They experimented with Sweat, Linonja's play. Right, where they went to, I mean, the hinterlands, they went to Ohio and Pennsylvania, places that, and they performed with, honestly, with like 6-7 actors in a bus in auditoriums. And I've seen the film footage from those shows. Mm-hmm. It's spectacular. I mean, it is spectacular. It's the old thing of like people who never see live theater, they're just blown away. Mm-hmm. And the show is speaking to them directly. So Oscar and I have talked about actually. You know, yeah, doing a more of a kind of a mono, kind of like regional thing, where there would be regions that we would try to actually put work into. I think that'd be exciting.
That'd be exciting.
I mean, you know, originally, you know, we were all charged with doing work about our places. I mean, Seattle Rep was doing. You did something, you did a musical here a couple years ago about Seattle, right?
About Seattle.
Wasn't it about the Northwest? I thought you did something. We were all doing plays about our hometowns, and that was worthy. I think it was worthy. I mean, I think that there's, millions of stories that people can tell happening here now.
Well, I tell you, I was the tour manager here at the Seattle Rep, so when you and Oscar need some help with your regional tour, well, other questions? Yes, Jane, and then Don.
How are you preparing your organization for your transition?
They're so happy. No, it's been good. I think it's been good. I mean, I did the Jay Leno farewell thing. I announced like 2 years ago I was going to give the incoming person time to plan their, you know, the full year, because usually you inherit a season that somebody else has picked, and it's kind of like because you're like, yeah, I love that play, I hate it, but you know, so you're trying to tap dance your way through that. So we tried to announce early enough. The board did an absolute spectacular job. They interviewed 38 people before the search, including this one over here, but they interviewed they did a huge R&D thing about like, what is this job? What is this job now? What does this job mean to you? What is this thing? So that was good. Then it kind of didn't completely work because they took too long to actually hire the person. So they went through an arduous process, and then I've tried to be really supportive. I mean, everyone's been actually super trying to be over, you know, they've been like, oh my God, don't mention it. And I'm like, hey, let's welcome Joanna. So, you know, I think I'm good at that. I was like, come on in, she's gonna be great. I think you're gonna be, I've been calming everybody down, honestly, because I think there's just fear about, again, it's like, what's this gonna be like? And I think it's gonna be good. I think it's gonna take time. It's a new person, she's really smart. She's a good human being. You know, I think it's gonna be good. So we've done a bunch of this. And then we're having a lot of, I'm having a farewell, a series of farewell parties, and they're gonna be, the last one's gonna be like, you know, it's gonna be legendary. So I believe in like, kind of like catharsis, like ritual. So like, I wanna be dumped. I wanna be the thing where they, you know, they build a scaffold and I'm in the thing. I want people that, for money, you have to throw the ball at me and put me in the, oh, this would be awesome. Awesome, right?
Yeah. Donald.
My question is, I would love to hear you mentioned like doing commercial things.
Right.
And so one of the kind of things that kind of disturbs me a little bit is, and I'm going to name a theater in New York.
Right.
So the Roundabout, for example, they do these commercial productions that they go straight to Broadway.
Right.
And in some ways, it what disturbs me about them is that they are a nonprofit. And so in some ways for me, so the their patrons are actually footing the bill for the most part for those productions, but their patrons are not bearing the benefits the benefits as if it were a real commercial production where they would get something back from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there, when you do those things, do you feel there's a kind of moral or ethical question mark about going about that?
I think the answer to that is yes, but we've taken some really pretty clear hard lines about the boundaries that we have around that. So actually, we don't spend any more than we would in a modestly priced show on any of those shows, number one. We do not. We aren't putting the theater at risk. We're not going to put Broadway at risk. We take less of a percentage on the back end because we do that, because the producers are putting up a lot more money, number one. Number two is, we're not doing a second-rate show. We are. If I said to us, I said to our staff, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this on, quote, our terms. So what are our terms? One, the content is that I want to do these shows. I want to do American Idiot. I want to do Passing Strange. I want to do Amelie. I want to do Ain't Too Proud. I wanted to do those shows. It wasn't like I was going, oh shit, we've got to do Ain't Too Proud. Like, this show is crack. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. This is the music of the Temptations, for God's sakes, and it's being told by really smart people with incredible craft, and it's a great story. So I'm not backfooting that. I don't go like I know a lot of my colleagues, oh, Christmas Carol, if I got to do Christmas Carol again, I'm going to do myself. You know, we're not doing that. I'm doing Ancient Proud. You know, so like I said, on our terms. The other thing is that the shows that are coming are not with second-rate casts. They're not with like of this other tier. Our audience is getting a you know, state-of-the-art show. So our audience is getting the benefit of seeing work that we could never afford to do on our own, in work in ways that are spectacular, and with which content reflects somewhat of who we are. Now, it does mean I reject a huge amount of projects. I mean, a huge amount of projects. Is there a moral line there? That absolutely is. And we ask ourselves that question every single time. A lot of it, Donald, gets down to who we're working with. Like, the list of commercial people that we work with is pretty small. It really is pretty small, because there are people like Tom Hulse is fantastic. Tom Hulse is a man of theater. He loves to support the work. His notes are spectacular. I mean, I'd work with that guy any day of the week. There are other people who I wouldn't. I just wouldn't, because I feel like the values that they are going to insist upon bringing into our house are not values I want to live with, or not values that the theater was built on. So it's a negotiated thing, but it's an important question to ask.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question. You mentioned earlier that it's essential for young theater professionals and students to brand themselves. You probably get asked this a lot, but many of us who are young and emerging directors are operating under immense amounts of student debts.
Right.
And having to move forward where even people who are working 9 to 5s cannot make ends meet.
Right.
And where we're asked to work for a salary and that's it, in front of our own money to produce. What advice would you give directors trying to develop their craft in these circumstances?
Couple of things. Again, find your friends. Find people you want to make work with. Find another way to creatively work that pays you money.
Yeah.
Pays you money. There's reasons why a lot of people, a lot of directors, you know, do not want to run theaters anymore. Because they're going to go work for Netflix. A bunch of people who I approached about my job just asked me if they were interested. They said, like, dude, love you, love Berkeley Rep, no way. I mean, I do think there are, you've got to spread you cannot think of yourself as I'm going to do regional theater. That model is just not happening. It's just, you'll just become a serial killer. And you look like a really lovely person, so I don't want to turn you into Dexter, right here.
I
at the risk of sounding like, you know, a heretic, you know, I do think you have to look for opportunities that in other fields, but that have creative, you know, alternatives for you that pay you money. Television is a boom industry right now. It's the gold rush right now. So, you know, if that is what's going to give you money, that's going to, you know, it's going to give you money. Other people have other solutions for that. People decide that they're going to teach, which is a wonderful thing to do. People decide, you know, you have to, obviously every person has a different set of requirements about how they want to live, which is affected by many, many, many factors. One of which is age, one of which is responsibilities, one of which is bills, you know, the whole thing. And you have to decide personally what level of stability you need to live a healthy life. You need to live a healthy life, you know, and that I also recommend getting physical exercise and eating vegetables. I'm serious. I'm serious. This is a profession where you have to stay in shape, spiritual, physical shape. And if you don't do that, you will suffer. You will suffer, and there's already enough hardship in the field without you adding a whole pile of other shit into your suffering list. So, I mean, you have to figure out your housing situation. You have to figure out, you know, your living situation. You have to figure out how you're going to, you know, like address the debt. and in a real way. But because, I mean, maybe there'll be a massive government program and all the debt will be forgiven. It'll be like, yay! It'll be great. But until that moment, so I do think you have to take care of yourself in like in a myriad of ways. You know, my sons, like I said, my boys are both artists, and they face exactly what you have to face now. But I always encourage them to do something creative just for themselves. I believe in writing. I don't mean just pen writing. I mean anything that is authorship, whether that's dance or singing or whatever. I just feel that the creative spirit needs to be fed and in a pretty disciplined way. And if you aren't having steady paid work, you have to figure out a way that you're going to do that on your own and take responsibility for that. Make sense? Sure.
Well, on that note, Tony, thank you. So Tony's in the midst of rehearsal. I can't wait to see what happens next for you, for us.
Me too.
So, thank you all for being here.
Thanks a lot.